While you're taking your places, I have a question to ask all of you I'd like you to think about for a while. Over the past few days, we've been seeing on the screen the familiar picture of Dr. C.F.W. Walther. And how many of you have ever wondered, when you see that picture, that so familiar picture of Walther, what was that photographer thinking? What would Walther look like on a bad hair day? Or what would Walther look like if we had Photoshop back then? That leads me to our next speaker. Who never has a bad hair day. Our next speaker needs no introduction, and he's not going to get one from me. What I'm not going to say about Dr. David Scare will serve as a better introduction than all the things that I could say about his years of service, or all of his books and papers, or all of his legendary classroom activities. Because Dr. Scare specifically asked me, actually he ordered me, not to talk about him, but to spend a few minutes talking to you about getting calls for our men. Dr. Scare has led the way in concern for those who waited for calls last year and for those who will likely wait again this year. Last year, 21 of our men did not receive calls on call night. And although the extra efforts of the district presidents resulted in calls for most of those men by the end of the summer, two men still remain without calls. And Dr. Scare's concern, my concern, and hopefully your concern will also remain. Nothing has changed as the call process for seminary candidates continues this year. Many of the calling congregations have worship practices which, although they are well within the acceptable doctrine and practice of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, are not within the personal preference or the academic formation of the majority of our candidates. The number of candidates from our seminary this year is actually a little bit larger than was the number last year. Not counting those students who are already in place due to convertible vicarage or contextual education programs, we need about 65 new calls in order to place all of our men, and St. Louis appears to need about 80 new calls to place all of theirs. And although we have a high number of vacancies in the Synod, the latest report from the Council of Presidents indicates only slightly over 200 congregations actively calling. All of you have a sphere of influence in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Some of you are circuit counselors. Some of you may be pastors of those permanently non-calling congregations. Still others may be neighbors to them. It's always my joy to thank you, and I thank you now on behalf of President Wenthe for all of the encouragement that you give, for the prayer support, the financial support to the seminary, and we pray that that encouragement from you would still continue. But now we'd like to ask you also to encourage those congregations who are not calling a pastor due to weak finances to reconsider. St. Paul gave us the example of the Macedonians who gave more than they were able. Encourage those congregations to look beyond their ability, to call a pastor who will feed them with the gospel, which is the only means to make any of us accomplish more than we are able. If we could just get half of those congregations who became permanently non-calling congregations within the last year to take this step of faith, we could easily place all of our candidates. Now, some of those congregations will not be financially viable until a pastor is in place, feeding God's people with God's word. In our placement interviews, I've asked many of our candidates if they're willing to serve a congregation who may be able to call them only at about 75 or 80% of beginning district scale. Are they eager and ambitious enough to bring God's means of grace to people so that they will know the grace of biblical giving that can make them financially viable again? Those men are willing. They are eager. And in 4 short months, they will be ready. So I'd like you to join Dr. Scare in his concern for our candidates that they be given a chance to serve the church, and that Walther and the third use of the law may not just be a symposia paper, but a daily activity in all of the church, where all who are made new by the power of the gospel do much more than the law could command, or even more than the proper third use of the law could guide them to do. Well, with that, time no longer allows me to say all the good things that Dr. Scare has given to this seminary in his years of service, all the books and articles that he has written and edited, all of the students he has challenged. It's my great pleasure to have been challenged by him in the classroom 34 years ago as a student. It's my great honor to serve with him on this faculty for over 2 of his 45 years. And my great privilege to introduce him as our next presenter on Walther and the Third Use of the Law. You know, it never ceases to amaze me that whenever alumni gather, at all the stories that are told about Dr. Scare. In fact, it reminds me of Bainton's quote of Luther with regard to the focus on the relics in the church. Don't get ahead of me here. Luther said, "And how does it happen that 18 apostles are buried in Germany when Christ had only 12? Now, I'm not saying that he's a relic. In fact, even today, his energy makes the Energizer Bunny look like a quitter. But if all of the stories about Dr. Scare were gathered together, there would have to be at least 3 of him for all of those things to have had happened. So please welcome him, the man, the myth, the legend, Dr. Scare.
Some housekeeping chores, and that is, if there's anybody who is lacking a banquet ticket, you could check at the desk. And if somebody would be so kind to bring in the gals who are working outside, that this was a mammoth undertaking this year. If you would look at your folder and see the application, how complex that was. We had the Carl Vicentius preaching seminar. We had people who had a choice of coming on 1 of 4 days. We had to figure out the financial situation of one of those things, and you had a banquet. Could somebody go out there and just bring those gals in who did all that work? Is anybody up to doing that out there? I remember the account with when Mr. Harrison was the clergy person at Zion, and down the aisle came a man who was inebriated or under drugs, and he came down the entire aisle. Is that you, Kara, there? Who the? Leanna. Those are the gals who made this thing go. Turn around. Those gals came in on Sunday in order to do the work. Well, getting back to the account of Mr. Harrison, and that this gentleman came down the aisle, and there were 4 ushers on duty. Not one usher did a darn thing. Mr. Harrison had to interrupt the sacrifice of the Mass and actually go down and take that guy down the aisle. That's one reason I've given up on the universal priesthood of all believers. It just doesn't work. Now to our topic. I have no idea who these people are. I do not know how to do a PowerPoint. If I knew how to do a PowerPoint, I would have given up my position and retired to Texas. To the topic. Well, with having clergy persons that look like that, you know why we had closed communion. That looks like Ben Mays from yesterday, doesn't it? Carl Ferdinand Wilhelm Walter's 24 Theses on the Law and the Gospel do not easily lend themselves for a developed doctrine on the third use of the law, an insight already made by 5th Vice President, Pastor Dr. Scott R. Murray. Werner Ehlert and Gerhard Forty proposed that the third use of the law, outlined in Article 6 of the Formula of Concord, was not held by Luther and hence has no place in Lutheran theology. Confusing the Reformed view that law in its third use prods the regenerate to do good works with the position of the formula may be one reason for its rejection among Lutherans. For Walther, the Reformed position of applying law to produce good works is a confusion of law and gospel, which is, after all, what his thesis is all about. Since Article 6 of the Formula of Concord has to do with law in all of its three uses, especially the second or accusatory function, it might better be entitled The Three Uses of the Law. Article 6 is already an extension of Article 4, Good Works, and Article 5 concerning... Holy smokes, I expect Misaki to come out the door. Concerning law, according to Article 6, good works flow from a free and merry spirit meeting the law's specifications. But at the base of the article is the Lutheran anthropology that the believer is more sinner than saint, and hence it speaks of the law's second use, that the sinful flesh needs to be threatened and compelled by the law. Christians as believers are driven by the Spirit of Christ to do good according to the law of Christ, that is the gospel. Apart from a reference to the Spirit of Christ, a Christological component in Article 6 is totally missing. Though the law has three functions, it has only one meaning as, quote, the unchanging will of God, according to which human beings are to conduct themselves in this life, end of quote. So the law's first, did you wonder why John Pless was doing this during his lecture yesterday? Did you see that? I wonder if he's got a problem. Really? So the law's first and third functions result in the same outward behavior in the performance of good works, with the proviso that deeds done according to the first use are driven by the fear of the law's penalty and the desire for reward. Good works done according to the third use come from the Spirit. First and second uses of the law resemble in each other in that failure results in penalties. Caught between the Reformed position that the third use is the imposition of the law's threats and how the believer as believer lives, and the Lutheran concentration on the second use, some theologians have found good reason to deny the third use altogether. This is exacerbated by a less than fully defined third use of the law in the formula of Concord, a matter to be discussed soon. The law-gospel paradigm by which Lutheran theology is usually defined, and the formula's lack of a fully developed definition of the third use, may have provided a basis among some Lutherans for ordaining women, and more recently, homosexuals. Should any regulations or prohibitions about these matters be identified in the scriptures, they would be superseded by the gospel, or so the argument goes. A less than fully developed doctrine of the third use in the formula and Lutheran theology in general is rooted in the Lutheran concentration on original sin, from which even in doing good works, believers remain sinners. In spite of their faith in Christ, believers are constantly going back to square one. So pervasive is the reality of sin that the discussion on the third use with its positive aspects soon reverts to the second use, as in the formula. Gilbert Mailander, in the recent issue of First Things, addresses this Lutheran dilemma. This is what he says. If I am inattentive, thoughtless, or even an abusive husband and father, and my neighbor is just the opposite, an exemplary husband and father, what a Lutheran too often has to say to us is exactly the same. That before God, we are sinners in need of justifying grace. And if I want to help become more like my exemplary neighbor, the message is precisely the same, that I am a sinner in need of grace. All of which is, of course, true. But it's not the only theological truth, nor the one that always best suits our condition. A theology that has learned to speak in such a monotone about grace, always as pardon but not as power, gives no guidance or direction to the serious Christian. The Christian life engaged only in a constant return to the pardoning word goes nowhere. Now, Walther's Law and Gospel informs classical Lutheran homiletical tradition that law and gospel are diametrically opposed to each other. Law not only serves but virtually exhausts its purpose in condemning sinners in preparation for hearing the gospel. Walther's theses do not develop the law's positive aspect in providing specific guidance on how Christians are to live. Walther speaks of renewal and love, but only in the sense that they, along with faith, are not the causes of one's salvation. A third use of the law may be implied in Walther's exegesis of Romans 3 and 4, in which he says, first the law threatens with the wrath of God, then the gospel announces the comforting promises of God. Then he adds, quote, this is followed by instruction regarding things we are to do after becoming new people, end of quote. But Walther does not elucidate what these things are. Walther regards law as divine threat and gospel as divine comfort, definitions that serve his ultimate purpose in showing that the two are not to be commingled. Believers converted by the gospel are not to be burdened with other requirements. Walther's concentration on the second use reflects Reformation thought, but he was probably also reacting to rationalism with its positive appraisal of man's moral capabilities, in which the law's accusatory function no longer was prominent. Within the context of 18th century Europe, the church as the Volkskirche was coextensive with the state, and so in practice, the first and the third use of the law became indistinguishable, virtually indistinguishable. Walther's experience with Pietism may have been more significant for his not providing an explicit discussion of the law's third use. After faith was created, Pietists reinserted regulations into Christian life, while the Reformed saw law as goading Christians to do good works. For Walther, the gospel was God's last word. But ironically, this idea,
that was given legs by Werner Ehlert and Robert Schultz in the 20th century provided a basis for the view that the law was not applicable in Christian life. Apart from the question of whether Walther's theology was abused or misunderstood, an abridged edition of Law and Gospel appearing under this title, God's No and God's Yes, and you have it on your shelf, by the way, suggests Law and Gospel are two incompatible revelations of God. Compared to promises of the gospel with no conditions attached, law with its conditions, prohibitions, condemnations, comes across as one big no. This characterization is so persuasive that many a Lutheran sermon predictably closes with an executive pardon for all transgressions. A discussion on the law in its three uses would have remained the purview of theologians had it not been for decisions of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America that were based on the law-gospel paradigm that the gospel is God's last word, though it should be quickly added, recent events would have taken place even without theological arguments. False doctrine is not as easily recognized as aberrant practice, and reactions in the ALCA to its own decision prove the point. Trinitarian issues have surfaced in a similar way to the issues of homosexuals. Much Trinitarian discussion is so abstract as to remain beyond the interest of many clergy and the grasp of the laity. But the introduction of an alternate form of the Lord's Prayer, addressing God as Mother, could not pass unnoticed even by an infrequent churchgoer. At that point, theology kicks in. If the first person of the Trinity can be known as Mother, then child can be and is substituted for son. And we might ask, why could not the second person of the Trinity be called the daughter? In use already, even in some Missouri Synod churches, is the Trinitarian alternative of Redeemer, of Creator, Redeemer. I don't want to say Redeemer too loud. We'll have all those people here from Rudisill. In use already is the Trinitarian alternative of Creator, Redeemer, Sanctifier that allows for the ancient heresy of modalism. For those who lived through the discussions leading up to the introduction of women clergy persons in the 1970s, recent ELCA decisions are a déjà vu, or as Dan Gard would say, déjà vu experience. Been there, seen that, and heard that. Then as now, arguments center around two fulcra. First, Old and New Testament citations, traditionally understood as disallowing these innovations, are reinterpreted. That's one approach. Secondly, even if the traditional prohibitions are acknowledged as correct interpretations of the disputed passages, they have been abrogated by the gospel. Gospel is God's last word, and the law has outlived its purpose. This argument is a form of dispensationalism popular among the Reformed, though it is rarely recognized as such. Arguments for ordaining women in the 1970s were more diverse and prolonged than those for ordaining practicing homosexuals. At least it seems to me. In one moment it was proposed, and in another accepted, or so it seems. Since regularizing the ordination of women, officially sponsored ELCA discussions on the issue have ceased. Ordination of homosexuals is already incontestable practice in the ELCA, matching incontestable dogma. These disruptive controversies might show that while Lutherans were absorbed with the law's second or accusatory functions, they should have been examining the law's third use in its application to the private and corporate lives of Christians. Since its formation, the ELCA has moved away from its Lutheran heritage by establishing fellowship with the Reformed, Episcopalians, Moravians, Methodists, and signed an accord on justification with the Catholics. Women, clergy persons, and theological students are becoming close to constituting a majority in these categories in the ELCA. Homosexual unions can be given marriage blessings. During the radicalization of church practice, a sense of what it means to be a Lutheran amazingly remains in the ELCA and has given birth to protest movements calling for reform and formation of new synods. A revival of that Lutheran spirit was evident in a gathering at Gethsemane Lutheran Church opposite the campus of this seminary, Concordia Theological Seminary, on the afternoon of Sunday, October 17, 2010, a couple of months ago. The speaker was Paul L. Spring, probably at one time a supervisor of John Pless, who has been in most every church there is in the United States. Maybe we can give him to the Wisconsin Synod. Complete sanctification. The speaker was Paul L. Spring, former bishop of the ELCA's geographic synods in Pennsylvania, and now interim bishop of the North American Lutheran Church, NALC. Objections raised there, at that meeting, to the recent ELCA decisions might be described more as intuitive rather than theological. One lady expressed dismay at allowing divorced clergy persons to remain as pastors. Another lay person asked for a definition of the word orthodox, a question unlikely to be raised at a similar Missouri Synod gathering. One pastor asked about whether natural law could be taught at the seminaries, a question with profound theological significance. These people were groping for reasons to counter the newer practices. In pastoral practice, most clergy allow for deviations both in practice and doctrine. But it is another matter when an entire church body regularizes a deviation. Regularized deviations and practices in the ELCA bring to the surface doctrinal aberrations that would have been otherwise remained unnoticed. In Bishop Spring's opinion, ELCA decisions to ordain practicing homosexuals were motivated more by cultural fluctuations than by agreed-upon biblical conclusions. Now, he did not mention that cultural forces were at work in the 1970s decision to ordain women. In both cases, the goals of ordaining women and homosexuals were in view by their proponents before and apart from the retrieval of biblical evidences and Catholic practice. Decisions and the ensuing discussions about ordaining women in the American Lutheran Church and the Lutheran Church in America, ALC, LCA, the major constituting churches of the ELCA, can best be explained in the cultural climate of the debate over the Equal Rights Amendment to the American Constitution. Rights women had in society were seen as rights they also had in the church. Voila, ordained women clergy persons. A malformed understanding of the universal priesthood of believers served this agenda well, as did the law-gospel paradigm, in which the gospel as God's last word trumped the law. Recent decisions reflect and correspond to current cultural values expressed in judicial, legislative, and executive actions, allowing gays to enter into contractual unions, marry, and serve openly in the military. When the church absorbs the prevailing culture into its practices and adjusts its theology to justify these practices, the church becomes so indistinguishable from society that it is no longer recognizable as church, a point Bishop Spring made in his lecture. Friedrich Schleiermacher constructed a forum of, that was one person that Marty Nolan didn't speak about, or maybe he did yesterday. Friedrich Daniel Ernst Schleiermacher constructed a form of Christianity from the German culture of the early 19th century. American churches may be constructing a religion out of the standards of Western culture, but without historic Christian components that were still available in the early 19th century German culture. Also lacking today is a noteworthy theologian like Schleiermacher. These innovations look for support in the law-gospel paradigm that characterizes Lutheranism and the denial by some scholars of the law's third use. These two things belong together, the law-gospel paradigm and the third use of the law and its denial. So we go back to the question of what role the third use had for Walther. His pastoral theology sets down standards for pastoral conduct and procedures for exercising discipline. Christians not living up to church standards could be expelled from the congregation. This looks like the law, but perhaps not in its third function. Walther's edition of the Bayer Compendium offers no section on the third use, but a definition may be extracted from the section on sanctification. Good works are described as spontaneous, an argument advanced in Article 4 of the Formula on Good Works, but not in Article 6. For Walther, justification precedes sanctification, the life of good works. But it is precisely in the discussion of sanctification where the law's third use has a place. Current confusion about the third use might have been tempered if it had combined with the formula's article on good works and the sections of Lutheran dogmatics on sanctification. Now, ordination of women and homosexual practices that find precedence in ancient Gnosticism and not in early church Catholicism were taking place in the Episcopal Church and the ELCA long before either church legitimated them. Arguments for these changes were not without biblical support, but the prevailing one offered by Lutherans was that the gospel is God's last word. Hence, any prohibitions concerning such behaviors are no longer applicable. Even though the law-gospel paradigm, as articulated by Walther and Ehlert, were not intended to support these practices or behaviors, it did. Call it unintended consequences, a phrase that I believe is eminently useful in theological discussion. The interpretation of the law-gospel paradigm, in which the gospel has the last word, finds collateral support in the now widely held view that Luther did not hold to the law's third use. This has proved to be a recipe for ethical disaster and ecclesiastical collapse. Yes, the law, depending on the circumstances, can be divided into functions, but there is only one law. Hence, an abrogation in one function of the law contributes to or reflects a parallel malfunction in the other two. Practitioners and supporters of homosexual behavior no longer have to sit in the pew to listen to the law's accusations from the pulpit. They are no longer called to repentance and faith. Confession in the confessional booth is adjusted by abridgment to the new standards. Only at one's own risk does a clergy person of a church allowing women and homosexual preachers, and the blessing of same-sex marriages preach against such behaviors. He, she will inevitably run afoul of church officials and compromise his or her political future, as Juan Pajola has demonstrated. Are you here? Is that Finnish person here? Is he here? He was suspended for 6 months. In the state-affiliated churches of Scandinavia, some pastors have already been subject to ecclesiastical censure and civil penalties. In regard to the law's first use, ELCA decisions are in line with what is allowed by governments in countries in the West, and in a kind of a perverse way, demonstrates that the formula's view that the law in its first and third uses result, or at least now, allow the same behaviors. This is not the case in Islamic countries and African countries with significant Christian populations, where such behaviors are frowned upon and have led some Lutheran church to contemplate breaking communion fellowship with the ELCA. Compared to Catholics and Lutherans, Reformed, Lutherans are less politically active, but this may prove to our detriment. What is allowed under civil law, the law's first use, is more easily accepted under the third use, and so redefines the Christian doctrine of sanctification. Seeing things in perspective helps. Saxon and Bavarian Lutherans, who arrived first in the Midwest in the 1830s, understood that the rationalist and pietist theologies from which they fled found a poor sister in the Lutheranism that sprang up a century before in colonial Pennsylvania and New York. Early Christian Lutheranism, that was good. Bless had something going for him there. Early American Lutherans had multivaried roots in Lutheran orthodoxy and pietism, and was soon overcome by German rationalism with an assist from New England Congregationalism, which turned into the Unitarianism of Harvard, where the president of the New York Synod, Frederick Quitman, had studied. The contagion of revivalism that loomed up in Jonathan Edwards' New England and was advanced in the Methodism of George Whitefield found its way onto the prairies where the new arrivals were settling. All this was brought together by Samuel S. Schmucker's American recension of the Augsburg Confession. To make sure that they were not trading European products for inferior American ones, leaders of the Lutheran immigration established their own synods, among which the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod still survives. Jumping out of the devouring flames of European rationalism into the American Protestant frying pan was not an option for Missouri's fathers. And so the lines were as quickly as sharply drawn between established Lutheranism and the burgeoning Lutheranism of the plains. Had the older American Lutheranism found entrance among the newly arrived immigrants, they would have escaped one devil to meet another with duller and less theologically honed horns. Zion on the Mississippi had to resist being overwhelmed by the waters that flowed from the Hudson, Delaware, and Susquehanna westward over the Appalachians to the Midwestern prairies. Zion's inhabitants sandbagged their fortress on the Mississippi against the eastern floods. Support for that is Isaiah 8, 6 to 8. Well, you know, the Wisconsin Synod guys say we don't take the Bible seriously. Well, in this complex of metaphors, which you probably are all lost already, lurks a composite parable that scientific principles are not hardwired. Take, for example, the principles that all rivers flow downward. This might be true unless it was March 1982 when the waters of the St. Joe met the swift flowing waters of the St. Mary coming from the south, and the St. Joe began to flow upstream. If commonly accepted principles are open to reevaluation, then so are common theological assumptions. Perhaps theological influences can flow in unexpected directions. Thus, influences from Missouri's Zion on the Mississippi could reverse course and flow north into ELCA seminaries. Well, according to Carl E. Broughton, this is what happened, and the details are provided in his Because of Christ, Memoirs of a Lutheran Theologian, published just last year. For years, Broughton, along with his co-editor, Robert W. Jensen, of the Christian Dogmatics, has been taken to task for holding a little less than an authentic Lutheran theology. But he turns the tables around in attributing ELCA problems to Missouri Synod Blue Bloods. Waters from Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, channeled through Christ Seminary in Exile, Seminex, flowed upstream to Chicago in 1982 when the former St. Louis faculty from Seminex now joined and then took control of the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, LSTC. Broughton relates how 10 former Seminex professors voted as a block to bring down the existing faculty structure and administration. Having taken the top faculty positions for themselves at LSTC, they put in place the egalitarian model of Concordia Seminary's administration under John Tejan, in which secretaries, janitors, and kitchen help were included in faculty social gatherings. This was more than a political maneuver, because in Broughton's opinion, theological antinomianism was at work. This is what he said, quote, "The theology that backed up the paradigm shift at LTSC was antinomian or a close relative. And all this was laid on the shoulder of former Missouri Synod clergy who found their way into his church." This is what he writes. The unexpected consequence of such a strong contingency of Seminex personnel was to move the faculty and student body to the left on social, cultural, and theological issues. Having been condemned as liberals and heretics in their home church, they became advocates of a progressive agenda in their new ecclesial setting. The poison of political correctness spread to every aspect of seminary life. So far, Broughton. Broughton takes it a step further in seeing these actions as the core of the resolutions adopted by the August 2009 ELCA convention regularizing the ordination of gays and the blessing of their unions as marriages. John H. Tejan anticipated this as the role of his faculty. Broughton is not the only one pointing the finger at the Missouri Synod for ELCA problems. At his October 17, 2010 presentation, Bishop Spring, well, I guess if we can go to communion with him, we can. Bishop Spring located the cause of what he called the antinomianism in the ELCA in gospel reductionism, and commended the late J.A.L. Preuss, may his soul rest in peace, for recognizing what it really was. Gospel reductionism extends the law gospel paradigm used in preaching, especially as it was set forth by Walther, into biblical interpretation in providing the only required meaning of a biblical text. If the biblical text gives birth to law and gospel, everything else is up for grabs. Now, the subtitle of Walther's Law and Gospel, I don't know if this was by Walther or whether the editor said, How to Read and Apply the Bible. That's the subtitle of your favorite book. Implied that law and gospel was more than a preaching technique, but it was a hermeneutical principle, and so it was taken. For self-styled, confessional-minded preachers, the core meaning of a biblical passage is exhausted if after bringing the people to their knees, they are lifted up by the gospel. In certain, and perhaps most cases, the imposition of the principle curtails rather than helps determine what was on the mind of the inspired writer. Walther did not preach like this, as is obvious from his robust engagement with the biblical texts. But the law-gospel principle came to form the basis of gospel reductionism. Preach law and gospel, and the preacher has license to say whatever he or she wants to say about the biblical text. How to read and apply the Bible said too much about Walther's book, and for that matter, any book. Well, I know a few exceptions. The next step is that ethical matters are up for grabs. Applied unilaterally, gospel reductionism results in antinomianism, as both Bishop Spring and Carl Broughton observe, and compromises the law in all three functions. Now, Bishop Spring said that culture, not scriptures, is determining the ELCA's agenda. Mylander speaks of Lutheranism's decline into antinomianism, word for word. In the mores of a society a century ago, mainline churches had no thought of ordaining women. This was something Pentecostal churches did. Two generations ago, the blessing of gay marriages was unheard of. Had the culture not lost its moral bearings, what is understood as the first use of the law, problems now affecting church life, matters of the third law's third use, would not have arisen. When the sense of right and wrong binding aside society together is eroded, it becomes difficult for the church to bring people to an awareness of their sin in preparation for the gospel. Reformed theologian Michael Horton has said, a man who was quoted too often in the Missouri Synod, if the church does not change culture, culture will change the church, a theme constantly reappearing in the periodical First Things. Though the task of improving culture has more of a place in Calvinism, culture has changed the church, and we are suffering the consequences. After his lecture, Bishop Spring told a circle of people gathered around him that the current ELCA problems were traceable to those Missouri clergy who, as members of the Association of Evangelical Churches, AELC, later involved in the formation of the ELCA, the same point Broughton makes in his autobiography. When two points are located on the circumference of a circle, the center can be located. Spring and Broughton serve as those points, and the lines to the center converge on the Missouri Synod. Particularly gospel reductionism, as it had emerged out of the law-gospel paradigm. Along with the intrusion of foreign theological elements into the body politic, Bishop Spring noted that a merger of the LCA and the ALC may not have taken place without the persistent instigation of the newly arrived dissident Missourians. Teagen takes credit for this union. Bishop Spring claims that even if a merger had taken place, but the Missourians had not been involved, the results would have been different in the merged church. Now, a bit of historical revisionism may be at play here, since already in 1972, the ALC had introduced the ordination of women, and the LCA soon followed suit. Plans to ordain women without synod approval were already afoot at that time at Concordia Seminary St. Louis under the Teagen administration. So on this issue, there was prior agreement. With one Lutheran church in view, a spirit of triumphalism may have overtaken the three uniting synods that did not allow them to recognize potentially disruptive practices. Matters among ELCA dissidents will be resolved only when they recognize that arguments used for the ordination of women were resurrected in regularizing a homosexual clergy. Now, claims made by some conservatives that emerging synods will be no different than the ELCA, that's something you hear among us, overlooks the serious attention that these theologians are now giving to defining the law. The antinomianism that surfaced in the August 2009 ELCA decisions was already at work in how the St. Louis faculty were organizing the Chicago Seminary. All were equal. Leaders in the egalitarian movement, as identified by Broughton, were Robert Bertram and Edward Schrader, who are described as, quote, founders of Crossing, an educational institution whose purpose was to relate the gospel to daily life. They followed Ehlert in rejecting the third use of the law, end of quote. So Scott Murray's assessment that Ehlert's denial of the third use of the law was a factor in the disruptions in American Lutheran theology is confirmed. Even if antinomianism cannot be laid at Ehlert's feet, his theology provided the soil for its growth. The egalitarianism at work in organizing the LSTC and later the ELCA was followed by libertarianism, which I suppose is an adequate synonym for antinomianism. Broughton says that for the new line of thought to, quote, offer any rules or restrictions regarding the sexual behavior of Christians is to legalize the gospel, that is, to make the gospel of God's love and forgiveness what the law is designed to do, end of quote. Broughton's vilification by Missouri Synod conservatives adds to the value of his appraisal. Springs and Broughton's appraisal of the ELCA is confirmed in letter 673, circulated by Edward Schrader, in which a certain Peter Kyle, K-E-Y-E-L, says that the scriptures do not require any one understanding of marriage or codes for sexual behavior. Setting up sexual behavior, in Kyle's opinion, sets aside faith and gospel as the rule by which Christians live. One has to ask why gospel freedom is not applicable to the other commandments in the second table and only to the sixth, or perhaps it is. The fifth has already been infringed upon by ELCA insurance plans funding abortions, an action probably taken without recourse to theological argumentation. And then there is the eighth commandment. ELCA officers have made the most unkind remarks about those who take exceptions to the new measures. If you don't know what they said about Bishop Spring and his group that they are a boil to be lanced and what they are doing is ludicrous. To which Bishop Spring replied, "Hell's going to freeze over before I resign." Now, isn't that amazing? You have to go to the ELCA to get the spirit of Luther. Think about it. After his lecture, Bishop Spring, and he's a small man, "We live in interesting times." Agreed, rightly or wrongly. The Missouri Synod is held responsible, at least partially, for another church's problems. Waters do sometimes flow upstream. Systematic theology serves to clarify church doctrine, but at times its structures may be too restrictive. This may be the case with the second use, monopolizing the definition of the law, so the ignoring of the third use of the law allowed for its denial. A solution might be found in expanding the definition of the third use to see it as a replication of what the law was in the paradise of Genesis 2, and then fast forwarding to the paradise of the end time. What Adam did by nature corresponded to what God required. For Adam, imperative and indicative were one thing. Interrogative was the grammatical form of the serpent. I already get a few brownie points with Nordling for that. That ought to spice up his life. That's not much of a challenge. I'm already up to the second chapter of his new book. That's further than he's gone. Adam's offense was not merely the abrogation of this or that commandment, but in his attempt to take the place of his Creator, his was an act of unfaith, if we dare speak like this. He believed the promise of the serpent's gospel that he and his wife would be like gods, and soon discovered that Satan is the father of lies. Adam inverted the image of God in which he was created so that he and not God defined the relationship between them. In those fleeting moments, when we love God and the neighbor more than we love ourselves, and I don't hold that to be law, the paradise understanding of the law reemerges as flickers of light in an otherwise dark place in which the law accuses us. Just as the third use of the law allows for a brief, temporary, and sporadic return to paradise lost, so it anticipates the final paradise when the second use of the law, with the first use of the law, will pass away and the redeemed will no longer be confronted by the law's accusations. At that time, from a cheerful and willing spirit, each of us will live in harmony with God and his neighbor. At that time, justification will no longer be forensic, a declaration that sins are forgiven, but it will be intrinsic. We will be righteous, as the etymology of the word justification suggests. Christ will completely envelop our existence. At that time, a complete theosis will be realized. In brief, the third use of the law is nothing else than sanctification that will, in the resurrection, reach and exceed the perfection of the first paradise. In the first paradise, God was the lawgiver. In the final paradise, he will be both lawgiver and fulfiller, and so the law will be endowed with a greater magnificence. Not only will the law's prohibitions and penalties be forever silenced, but the law shall be recognized for what it is, as the perfect description of God. It will no longer be God's no and God's yes. It will be God's yes and God's yes. All this is anticipation of what will be and comes to life here from time to time when brothers and sisters live in peace with one another. We might even find a place for Luther's doctrine of vocation and discover that it is nothing else than the application of the third use of the law, because each performs the work assigned to him or her, a principle that Adam did not understand. Recent ELCA decisions can be seen as offenses in the light of the natural law and specific biblical prohibitions. But ultimately, they must be seen as offenses against Christ. Again, this leads us to the conclusion that the most significant deficit in Lutheran definitions of the third use of the law is the Christological component. Current crises bring up the question of whether the gospel is God's last word. Well, yes, perhaps in the sense that what Christ has done comes alive in the life of Christians. But consider these words. This is what Jesus said. Greater love has no man than this, than that a man lay down his life for his friends. That's gospel, and it's third use altogether. Now, I am not so sure when the formula says that the first and third uses of the law produce the same external results. I'm not sure about that. At the end time, the first and second uses of the law will pass away, and only the third will remain. Maybe that's what St. Paul meant when he said, "So faith, hope, love abide, these three, but the greatest of these is love." Thank you very much.